Hitler's War by David Irving. Chapter is, Do You Recognize My Voice? As Hitler's Condor touched down at Rustenburg Airfield, thousands of Tott Organization laborers were still working on the Führer's headquarters. The old site used for Barbarossa was now barely recognizable. The mammoth bunkers rearing up out of the trees had been expertly camouflaged against enemy reconnaissance. There was turf and there were trees on the flat roofs. How beautiful it is here, Carl thought, a stenographer noted in his diary. The whole site is resplendent with luscious greenery. The woods breathe a magnificent tranquility. The wooden hutments have meantime been heavily bricked in to afford protection against bomb splinters. End quote. The noon war conferences were temporarily transferred to one of these gray-painted huts, at one end of which a 40-foot-long conference room had been created by simply knocking down two partition walls. The room thus had windows on three sides. It was light and airy and filled with the fragrances of the surrounding woods. Poor health was again bothering the Führer. On this day, July 14, 1944, Professor Morell noted after examining him, quote, influenza and conjunctivitis in both eyes. Shampoo got into his left eye, smarting badly, end quote. The physician soothed the pain with a standard cocaine adrenaline solution. This was the least of Hitler's woes. For the first time, Keitel and Fromm had opened discussions with Bormann on command relationships in the likely event that the Reich itself became a battleground. At long last, too, Hitler had bowed to pressure to implement the doctrine of total war. Here at the Wolf's Lair, he received from Dr. Goebbels a long letter protesting at the continued under-exploitation of the Reich's vast manpower resources. Quote, at this moment, with East Prussia preparing to defend her soil, every postal delivery in Berlin brings fresh invitations to official receptions, to parties, to games, or to displays, unquote. Goebbels pleaded with Hitler, quote, give absolute power to one man you can trust for every problem requiring a rapid solution, unquote. Ingratiatingly, he added, quote, every time I see you, I look to see what your health is like. When you came to Berlin for the state funeral of General Huber, risking death from American fighter aircraft, I was shaking with fear, I confess. You alone, mein Führer, are our guarantee of victory. End quote. This was unquestionably true. No man possessed the authority over the German people that Hitler did, even at this gloomy pass in their fortunes. If he succumbed now, nothing would halt the Soviet avalanche, least of all his querulous generals. Yet the Germans were still waiting for Hitler's ultimate appeal. Goebbels besought him, quote, by calling all England to arms after Dunkirk, did Churchill thereby condemn her to die? And Stalin, when he proclaimed during our advance in Moscow, better to die on your feet than live on your knees, did he imperil the whole USSR? End quote. Quote, our return was very timely, wrote Martin Bormann privately on July 15th. The Führer has had to come here in person to stiffen the often shamefully weak-kneed attitude of the Army's officers, end quote. Hearing that the nervous General Eftaff, or the General, his name is spelled F-T-A-F-F, so I don't know if it's Taff or whatever, had evacuated 5,000 of its officers from East Prussia to the west. Goebbels remarked in his diary, quote, I'd like to kick out every cowardly man jack of them. End quote. The optimism of the quote unquote party faithfuls like himself was certainly limitless. Himmler, who visited Hitler that day, was soon writing to Kaltenbrunner, quote, how are we going to rule and pacify Russia when we reconquer large parts of her, as we certainly shall in the next years? End quote. Hitler had ordered a new defensive line rapidly built along the entire Eastern Front, following the rivers San and Vistula to the Warsaw Bridgehead, and then the Narev and a line forward of the Reich frontier to the Baltic. The 15 new quote-unquote grenadier divisions ordered by Hitler were being raised in the Reich. The army had issued the first order over General Stief's signature on July 8th, but Hitler wanted more urgency, and now, on July 15th, he summoned to the Wolf's Lair both General Fromm and his chief of staff, the colonel with the now familiar yellow briefcase. Most midday war conferences were here were interminably long, but this conference lasted only half an hour, from 1:10 to 1:40 p.m. As a special session on the reconstitution of the shattered Eastern Front followed until 2:20 p.m., Hitler cold-heartedly laid down that the refugee families were to be stopped east of the new line and the able-bodied members diverted to the fortification works. Quote, "Things are pretty grim here," wrote Martin Bormann. 3 days later, the Russians are at Augustov near the East Prussian frontier. The new divisions still lack the necessary anti-tank weapons. We have plenty of worries, and it's a good thing the Führer is here. End quote. On July 19th, Hitler ordered two East Prussian divisions raised from the province's elderly Home Guard. In this connection, Fromm's chief of staff was again detailed to report to Hitler the next day. In France, the Allies were mercilessly bombing the Germans still containing the beachhead. Flame-throwing tanks were incinerating the inmates of the stubborn pillbox bunkers. Late on July 17th, Field Marshal Kluge telephoned Hitler with the shattering news that Rommel's car had been strafed by an Allied plane. The Field Marshal would be in the hospital for many months. The next 2,000 bombers hit the stronghold he had built at Caen. Over 2,000 French civilians were found dead in the city's ruins. Hitler's world was thus beginning to crash. In Italy, the German 14th Army pulled out of the Leghorn, Livorno. In Denmark, communist resistance cells were waging overt partisan warfare. In Hungary, too, there were ominous rumblings. Hungary was now flatly refusing to deport the Jews from Budapest. Instead, Horthy announced, a general would be bringing Hitler a letter on July 21st. The reasons for Hitler's discontent were therefore manifold. His irritation was such that on July 18th, he dismissed one of his adjutants, SS Colonel Fritz Dargis, transferring him to the Eastern Front because of a minor incident involving a winged insect in the conference hut. Lunching in his bunker that day with Secretary Christa Schroeder, he was clearly ill at ease. Once he exclaimed, quote, "Nothing must happen to me now, because there's nobody else who could take over," end quote. He had premonitions of trouble and commented uneasily, quote, "There is something in the air," end quote. 2 days later, he admitted to Mussolini that he had first experienced these forebodings during the recent flight back to the wolf's lair. On July 29th, he was to say, quote, "I admit I long expected an assassination attempt," end quote. But from which quarter, the field marshals or the generals? Some, like General Feldgebel, chief of signals, were conspicuous by their hostile remarks. But as Jodl was to note on the 24th, quote, "The Führer always good-naturedly overlooked them and held a protecting hand over them," end quote. Alternatively, the enemy might launch a paratroop attack on the Wolf's Lair itself. Himmler discussed this possibility with Hitler on the 15th. An entire battalion was concealed in the woods with tanks and anti-aircraft guns. Even in Rommel's absence, Army Group B still considered that although the enemy had landed 40 divisions in France, there were 40 more available in Britain. By late on July 18th, however, the enemy breakthrough east of Caen called for urgent remedial action. Kluge telephoned the next morning to demand that the 116th Panzer Division be withdrawn from the 15th Army and thrown into the breach. Hitler authorized this immediately, thus accepting for the first time that the 15th Army was waiting for an invasion of the Pas-de-Calais that might never come. He instructed Field Marshal Kluge to take command of Rommel's Army Group as well. At noon on the 19th, Kluge telephoned Keitel, quote, "Without doubt, we've got a crisis on our hands here," he said, and end quote. He was planning to address his senior commanders immediately behind the battlefront. Quote, "Good luck," said Keitel. "Take care of yourself," end quote. Hitler trusted Kluge. At 11:45 a.m., it was now the 20th. Morel came to give him the usual injections and administer drops into Hitler's reddened right eye. After lunch, Mussolini was expected here at the Wolf's Lair. For political reasons, Hitler had earlier conceded to him that the right to raise 4 new divisions of troops. But on July 19th, Hitler had tentatively decided to disband all 4 divisions. On consideration, he felt that no good could come of them, and that their army, or that their German training personnel and equipment were badly needed for the new German divisions. He had sent to Bodenschatz to put his suggestion to Marshal Graziani. Now, on the 20th, Hitler was undecided about seeing Mussolini. He ordered the Italians' train shunted around the East Prussian countryside, and his regular 1 p.m. war conference brought forward 30 minutes. Schaub arrived about 12:25 p.m. to tell him that the officers were assembled. As Hitler walked the 40 yards to the gray conference hut, he saw Varlamont and other officers waiting outside. The day was oppressively hot, and the windows of the conference hut, it had been Fritz Tott's office, were wide open. Sonnleitner asked what time he should fix the appointment for Mussolini. Hitler replied that he desired to be sure of the situation on the East Prussian frontier first. He could not allow Mussolini's life to be endangered. General Heusinger, standing to Hitler's right, began briefing him on the Eastern Front. Shortly afterward, Keitel arrived, accompanied by General Bulow and Fromm's chief of staff, the one-armed, one-eyed colonel with the yellow briefcase. Quote, "Mein Führer," Keitel announced, "this is Colonel Count Schenk von Stauffenberg, who is to brief you on the new divisions," end quote. Sonnleitner, clutching his sheaf of telegrams and intercepted Italian embassy dispatches, saw Stauffenberg adopt his usual stiff, almost fanatical Prussian posture, flinging his left arm up in a Hitler salute before shaking hands. Hitler shook the colonel's mutilated hand, then resumed his seat on a wicker stool. Once he asked for a detail, but it appeared that the colonel had stepped outside. There were now 24 men in the room. Hitler leaned across the maps, propping himself on his right elbow. There was a bunch of pencils in his right hand and a magnifying glass in his left. For Hitler, this was the dividing instant between an old world and a new. A blinding yellow flash engulfed him as 2 pounds of explosives detonated less than 6 feet away. His impression was that the blast came from just to the right of Colonel Heinz Brandt. Quote, "The swine are bombing us," thought Hitler. He heard a distinct double crack. Opaque smoke filled the room. He found himself lying near the left door jamb. He was covered with ceiling lathes, glass wool insulation, and timbers. He could feel his hair and clothes on fire, and his right elbow was hurting savagely. As the choking fumes parted, his smarting eyes made out faces contorted by screams of pain which he could not hear. His aides and adjutants fled, bolting through the doors and windows. Was there gunfire? He could not hear. He was deafened by the blast. Had a Soviet paratroop attack begun? If he tried to get out of the windows, he might blunder straight into the enemy's guns. He painfully extricated himself and stumbled into the corridor, beating out the flames on his ragged black trousers. They looked like a hula skirt. Supported by Sonnleitner and Keitel, who had simply shaken his towering frame free of debris, Hitler limped outside. Charred documents spiraled down from the sky. Keitel ventured, quote, "Mein Führer, that must have been one of the Tott workmen," end quote. Hitler shifted his weight onto Sonnleitner and confidently growled, quote, "A German workman would never lift his hand against me," end quote. As he limped to his bunker, he added, quote, "I always sensed this opposition to me in the general staff. Stalin knew what he was doing when he rubbed out Marshal Tchaikovsky. But now I shall make a clean sweep," end quote. While Dr. Morell was sent for, Hitler sat down unsteadily, jacketless in shirt sleeves and braces, and took his own pulse. 72, normal. He was pleased at his self-composure. His secretaries came in, and he grinned with smoke-blackened features at them. Quote, "Well, ladies, things turned out well again," end quote. He withdrew into his bedroom, walking taller than for some time. Morell took Hitler's pulse and confirmed 72. Helped by his surgeon colleague, Hans Karl von Hasselbach, he removed the shredded trousers and, revealing that the skin on the lower third of both thighs had been badly torn by the explosion, altogether they removed over 100 splinters of the fragmented oaken trestle from his legs. His hair was singed, his face had been cut in a score of places by flying splinters, and his forehead was scarred by a falling roof timber. Quote, "It was the work of a coward," he exclaimed. He sent out guards to search for the hidden fuse cable and for possible additional bombs. He sent the similarly blood-stained and deafened Colonel von Bello to the telephone exchange 100 yards away to summon Goering from his bunker. The colonel removed all the jacks from the telephone switchboard and forbade the telephonist to go near them. Shortly, Hitler learned that the blast wave had evidently originated above floor level. Moreover, only a handful of officers had known that the war conference would be brought forward because of Mussolini's visit. At about 1:15 p.m., he reemerged into the sunshine, wearing a fresh uniform over bandages that covered all injuries but those to his head. To General Feldgebel, the signals chief, whom he espied strolling deliberately up and down outside the security zone's perimeter fence, Hitler must have appeared unscathed. He had certainly fared better than his staff. Those who had been on his right had suffered the worst. Colonel Heinz Brandt had lost a foot. Quote, "It always did hurt anyway," he joked wanly, lying on the grass outside. Korten had been impaled by a jagged table fragment. Schmunt had ghastly leg injuries and an eye gouged out. Stenographer Berger had lost both legs. Hitler appointed him to a high civil service grade forthwith, so that the widow could draw a pension. A provident gesture, for Berger died that afternoon. Hitler's secretary, Christa Schroeder, later vividly recalled those hours. Quote, "I did not expect to be called in for lunch with him after the assassination attempt, but nonetheless I was sent for to join him. I was astounded to see how fresh he looked, and how sprightly he stepped towards me. He described to me how his servants had reacted to the news. Heinz Linge was indignant. Arndt had begun to cry. Then he said verbatim, quote, "Believe me, this is the turning point for Germany. From now on, things will look up again. I'm glad the Schweinhund have unmasked themselves," end quote. I told him he couldn't possibly meet the Duce now. Quote, "On the contrary," he retorted, "I must. What would the world press say if I did not?" And end quote. Quote, "Duce, I have just had the most enormous stroke of good fortune," unquote, Hitler said in greeting his Italian guest emerged from his train at 2:30 p.m. For a while, the Duce was left to his own devices. Security Zone 1 was packed with armored vehicles which had crawled out of the woods, but the cause of the blast was still a mystery. It was now that Martin Bormann brought to Hitler the corporal who had tended the telephone outside the conference room. This man had seen a colonel with one arm leave in a hurry just before the explosion, without his briefcase, cap, and belt. The army officers angrily rejected the corporal's implied libel on the worthy Colonel von Stauffenberg, but suspicion against him hardened during the afternoon. The Gestapo investigators found shreds of the yellow leather briefcase embedded in the wreckage. Stauffenberg had bluffed his way past the cordons and left at 1:13 p.m., ostensibly for Berlin's Rangsdorf airfield, but he had not arrived there. Shortly before 4 o'clock, his chief, General Fromm, telephoned Keitel from Berlin and said that rumors were flying around the capital, and ought he declare a state of emergency? Quote, "The Führer is alive," Keitel rasped. "There is no cause whatever for that. Is Stauffenberg in Berlin?" End quote. Fromm, taken aback, replied, quote, "No, I thought he was at Führer's headquarters," end quote. Almost at once, the Wolf's Lair began monitoring the most extraordinary orders emanating from Fromm's office to the territorial army commands, Wirtkreise, proclaiming a state of emergency by the code word Valkyrie. By telephone, too, the commands were being instructed that Field Marshal Erwin von Witzleben, Rundstedt's predecessor, was now supreme commander of the Wehrmacht, and that he had appointed General Erich Hoppner commander of home forces. There's an asterisk. The conspirators had not realized that a special network fed all orders issued to the Wehrkreise to the Führer's headquarters automatically as well. This slip was crucial to the crushing of the putsch. The emergency from obscurity of these forgotten, forcibly retired, or cashiered army officers could only mean that any army putsch was being attempted in Berlin. That an army putsch was being attempted in Berlin. Hitler forthwith accepted Himmler's proposal that the Gestapo be given powers to arrest army officers. Since Fromm was prima facie one of the conspirators, Hitler neatly legalized the move by appointing Himmler his successor, thus giving the SS leader control over all army units in the Reich. With this and Hitler's specific directive to restore order, Himmler and Kaltenbrunner took off by plane for Berlin at once. Hitler had ordered Himmler on no account to allow his Waffen-SS to come into direct confrontation with the army. That would be the first step toward the ultimate tragedy of civil war. Keitel's energetic countermeasures crushed the push in the provinces before it even began. At 4:15 p.m., his dramatic message went out to the Werkkreise, quote, "Most immediate. The Führer is alive, safe and sound. Reichsführer SS new commander of replacement army. Only his orders valid. Do not obey orders issued by General Fromm, Field Marshal von Witzleben, or General General Hoppner. Maintain contact with local Gallater and police commander." End quote. Shortly afterward, General Helmut Stief telephoned Keitel at Zossen. Fromm's office was proclaiming that the army had taken power. At 4 p.m., said Stief Stauffenberg, and General Ludwig Beck had phoned Wagner from Berlin. There's an asterisk. Stauffenberg had cautiously landed elsewhere than that at Rangsdorf Airfield, only to find neither car, driver, nor gasoline waiting there for the drive to the city. This evidently cost him 90 minutes delay. Back up. Beck was claiming to have taken over. Witzleben was said to be on his way to Zossen at that moment. Toward 5 o'clock, this was confirmed beyond a doubt. A long telegram signed by Witzleben and countersigned by Stauffenberg was monitored. Being transmitted to the Werkkreis commands, it exploited the overwhelming loyalty of these officers to Hitler by suggesting that not they, but party malcontents were behind the putsch. Quote, "Internal unrest. An unscrupulous clique of combat-shy party leaders has exploited the situation to stab the hard-pressed armies in the back and seize power for their own selfish purposes. In this hour of supreme danger, the Reich government has declared martial law to preserve law and order and appointed me supreme commander of the Wehrmacht with absolute executive authority." End quote. Long, detailed instructions for the incorporation of the Waffen-SS, the quote-unquote elimination of the Gestapo, and the ruthless breaking of any opposition followed. Accordingly, a warning was radioed by Hitler's HQ to Himmler's aircraft to divert a Berlin airfield guarded by reliable SS troops. Field Marshal Model, commanding Army Group Center, telephoned. He had received from Bendlerstrasse an order commencing, quote, "The Führer Adolf Hitler is dead," end quote, but he had refused to obey it. Hitler sent for his press chief and ordered a succinct communique broadcast immediately to the people. It would announce, quote, "A bomb attack was made on the Führer today. Apart from minor burns and bruises, the Führer was uninjured. He resumed work immediately afterward and, as planned, received the Duce for a lengthy discussion," end quote. Hitler subjected Mussolini to the usual impressive statistics of Speer's forthcoming production of tanks, guns, and ammunition, and secretly confided that soon there would be a new weapon, a V-2. He was resolved to, quote, "raise London to the ground," and "after August, September, or October," unquote. The new secret U-boats would also enter service. At 5 o'clock, tea was served in the headquarters mess. Schaub was called to the telephone. Hitler's personal adjutant, Alvin Broder Albrecht, was on the line, calling from the Reich Chancellery. Strange events were afoot in Berlin. Streetcars were rattling through the government quarter without stopping, and the area was being cordoned off by troops. Simultaneously, Goebbels phoned on his private line from Berlin. The commander of the Guards battalion, Major Otto Ernst Rehmer, had been instructed to occupy the government quarter. Quote, "Has the army gone mad?" unquote, the propaganda ministry asked. At 6 o'clock, the dissidents began issuing a new telegram to the Werkkreise, this time signed by, quote, "General Fromm," unquote. Fromm had not, in fact, signed the order. This instructed them to, quote, unquote, "secure all communications and arrest all ministers and leading party and police officials." Fearing that he was losing control of events in Berlin, Hitler phoned Goebbels to find out when the radio communique announcing his survival would be broadcast. Goebbels replied that he was sitting on it until he had composed a fitting commentary to go with it. Hitler exploded in anger, quote, "I didn't ask you for a commentary, I just want the news broadcast as fast as possible," end quote. At 6:28 p.m., the radio service was interrupted with a startling news flash. This dealt the first body blow to the putsch, for a live Hitler's word was still very much the law. The awkward tea party with Mussolini continued until about 7 o'clock, when the doors were opened and he was ushered out into the light drizzle. Quote, "The Duce's cloak," ordered Hitler. end unquote. Then they parted, never to meet again. Almost immediately, Goebbels was on the telephone again, this time with a highly suspicious Major Reamer at his side. Unable to discern whether his own army superiors or the wily propaganda minister was attempting to overthrow Hitler. Hitler was heard shouting into the telephone, but with his ears deafened, he could hardly hear the answers. He was asked to speak to Reamer himself. Quote, Major Reamer, can you hear? Do you recognize my voice? End quote. Reamer could and did. Once heard, Hitler's voice was unforgettable. Quote, Major Reamer, continued Hitler, they tried to kill me, but I'm alive, Major Reamer. I'm speaking to you as your supreme commander. My orders are to be obeyed. You are to restore order in Berlin for me. Use whatever force you consider necessary. Shoot anybody who tries to disobey my orders. End quote. This was the second deadliest blow to the plot, for it enabled Hitler to use the army itself to put down the conspiracy. Hours of suspense passed at the Wolf's Lair. The injuries began to tell on Hitler's physique. Quote, I am beginning to doubt that the German people is worthy of my genius, he exclaimed. And unquote. A sullen outburst that provoked a clamor of loyal protestations. Donitz reminded him of the Navy's achievements. Goering could not match this, so he picked a quarrel with Ribbentrop, who reported, quote, I am still the foreign minister, and my name is von Ribbentrop. End quote. Goering brandished his marshal's baton at him. I gotta read that Goering book. Goering's such a prick. At 8 p.m., Dr. Morell checked Hitler's pulse again. It was now 100, but strong and regular. He treated the injuries with his own, quote-unquote, penicillin powder, which was in fact quite useless, if not actually toxic, and dictated these notes to his typist. Quote, right forearm badly swollen. Prescribed acid aluminium acetate compresses. Effusion of blood on right shin bone has subsided. On back of third or fourth finger of left hand, there is a large burn blister. Address this. Occiput partly and hair completely singed. A palm-sized second-degree burn on the middle of the calf and a number of contusions and open flesh wounds. Left forearm has effusion of blood and interior aspect and is badly swollen. Can move it only with difficulty. Took him to take two optolidones, an analgesic and painkiller, and two tablespoons of Brom Nervicit, a tranquilizer, before going to sleep. End quote. Bormann had meanwhile purveyed what scanty information he could to the Gauleiters using his modern teleprinter link-up. There's a quote, an asterisk. This was another circuit that the plotters had failed to immobilize. Quote, they should have gone to school with us Nazis, Hitler scoffed to Schaub. Then they would have learned how to do it. Back up. Quote, the reactionary criminal Vermin evidently staged the attack on the Führer and his loyal officers in conjunction with the National Committee, quote-unquote, Free Germany, in Moscow. General von Seydlitz and Count Haubold von Einsiedel. Should the attack succeed, the general's clique comprising Fromm, Friedrich, Ulbricht, and Hoepner would take over power and make peace with Moscow. That this so-called peace would cost the German people their lives is obvious. That the attempt has misfired means the salvation of Germany, because now the hopes reposed in these traitorous generals have been smashed for good. End quote. At 9:40 p.m., Bormann warned the Gauleiters, quote, a General Beck wants to take over the government. The one-time Field Marshal von Witzleben is posing as the Führer's successor. Of course, no National Socialist Gauleiter will allow himself to be taken in or accept orders from these criminals, who are just miniature worms in format. End quote. Dining with his secretaries that evening, Hitler voiced his anger at the assassins. Quote, what cowards! If they had drawn a gun on me, I might still respect them, but they didn't dare risk their own lives. End quote. He snorted, quote, the idiots cannot even imagine the chaos there would be if the reins slipped out of my grasp. I'm going to make an example of them that will make anybody else think twice about betraying the German people. End quote. At the 10 p.m. war conference, he began expressing his regrets to the two duty stenographers over the death of their colleague Berger. He ordered a particularly violent V1 attack on London during the night to show that he was less inclined to compromise than ever. The radio sound truck from Königsberg had now arrived. Hitler's entire staff assembled in the tea house at 11:30 p.m. General Jodl, with a white bandage around his head, Keitel and with bandaged hands, others with sticking plasters, many men were missing. His voice trembling with emotion, Hitler recorded a fiery speech to the nation. Quote, "So that you can hear my voice." A minuscule clique of ambitious and unscrupulous officers of criminal stupidity has been plotting to get rid of me and to liquidate virtually the entire German Wehrmacht command staff at the same time. The bomb was planted by Colonel Count von Stauffenberg and exploded 6 feet away to my right. Several of my dear colleagues were gravely injured. One has died. I myself am completely uninjured, apart from a few minor scratches, bruises, and burns. I regard this as fresh confirmation of the mission given me by Providence to continue toward my goal." End quote. The speech was broadcast 90 minutes later. By that time, Hitler had heard that Stauffenberg had sworn to the assembled staff officers in the Army's Bendlerstrasse building that he had, quote, "seen the officer's corpse being carried past on a stretcher," unquote. And there's an asterisk. Quote, "Keitel is lying," Stauffenberg assured Albrecht and Hoppner. He had seen an explosion like the impact of a 150-millimeter shell and doctors running over. Hardly anybody could have survived. This emerging from the trials and interrogations. And back up. The arrest list was swelling. General Feldgebel's very presence, uninvited at the Wolf's Lair, had compromised him. Keitel sent for him at midnight and arrested him. Hitler was mystified that this general, the army chief of signals, had failed to gun him down that very afternoon. Quote, "There he was, ambling up and down like a lamb as though he had nothing to do, with this conspiracy." End quote. In Vienna and Prague, the plotters' orders had been largely carried out. In Paris, the military governor had actually put the Gestapo and SS chiefs under lock and key. The position of Field Marshal von Kluge was ambiguous. For an instant of black comedy, the loyal General Hermann Reinecke, attempting to telephone General Fromm that evening, had found the doomed General Beck on the line, and Beck had imagined he had reached Kluge in France. Quote, "Kluge, is that you?" Unquote. Witzleben telephoned Keitel from his hideout during the night. The OKW chief kept him talking long enough to find out where he was, and then ordered his arrest, too. A telegram from Fromm in the small hours spelled out the end of the putsch. Quote, "Attempted putsch by irresponsible generals has been bloodily put down. All the ringleaders shot. I have resumed control, after having been temporarily held under armed arrest." Unquote. Undeceived, Hitler ordered General Fromm's arrest as well. At 3:40 a.m., Martin Bormann circulated the triumphant teleprinter message to the Gauleiters. Quote, "The traitor's action can be regarded as at an end." Hitler saw the day's events as a temporary aberration, a kind of blood poisoning which the army would get out of its own system. The perpetrators had been, quote, "shot by the army's own battalions," unquote. The press announced in a special editions the next day. An infelicitous choice of words which caused many ordinary Germans to ask just how large the quote-unquote minuscule clique of traitors was. The Führer pushed the occurrence itself out of his mind. After emotionally sending the torn gray uniform jacket and black trousers to Eva Braun as a memento, they would be ceremoniously burned by the U.S. Army in 1947. From Field Marshal Kluge's forward headquarters at La Roche-Guyon, a special courier arrived with two letters. The first was from Kluge himself, the second from Rommel, written on July 15th before his injury, recommending that Hitler end the war. Rommel complained vigorously that 225 tanks had been lost, but only 17 replaced. His infantry divisions lacked artillery, armor-piercing weapons, and above all, bazookas. Quote, "Our troops are fighting heroically all along the line, but the unequal battle is nearing its end. In my view, you should draw the necessary conclusions. I feel bound as the Army Group's commander-in-chief to say quite bluntly." End quote. Kluge backed Rommel. Quote, "Unfortunately, the Field Marshal's view is right." End quote. Hitler disagreed. He would comment a few days later that this was, quote, "a struggle which cannot be discharged or disposed of by negotiation. A clever Kluge politics or by clever politics or by tactical sleight of hand," end quote. Obviously, it was a temptation for Kluge to withdraw his hard-pressed armies from Normandy to some more distant line of defense, though such a line would certainly be far longer. As Hitler told Jodl on July 31st, however, quote, "If we lose France, we lose the basis of our U-boat campaign," end quote. Moreover, France was Germany's last source of tungsten. Most of the Normandy divisions were immobilized by lack of transportation. The rest, only a few, would ever reach whatever new line the generals might propose to defend. No, Kluge and his generals must stand fast where they were, until Goering had recovered at least partial air supremacy in the west. Nonetheless, Hitler was prepared for the worst. On July 23rd, he ordered the West Wall fortifications, which had been built in 1938, to be ready for the defense of Germany. 2 days later, a new Allied offensive began in Normandy. The British thrust toward Falaise was halted by a countermove of the 1st SS Panzer Corps, but late on the 30th, the Americans managed to punch a dangerous hole through the line at the coastal town of Avranches. Hitler now instructed the OKW to prepare the Somme-Marne-Saône-Jura line for immediate occupation in the event of a collapse. Meanwhile, strong garrisons commanded by officers of proven courage must be sacrificed to defend the main French ports and deprive the enemy of their use. The French railways must be destroyed down to the last freight car and sleeper. On no account was any hint of these strategic decisions to reach the army group headquarters in France, for who knew how many traitors still lurked there, waiting to pass the word to the enemy. After all, the military commander of France, General Karl Heinrich von Stulpnagel, had made common cause with the Putschists of July 20th. Quote, "Let's be quite clear on one score," Hitler expounded to Jodl. "The tide in France cannot turn until we manage, even just for a short time, to regain air superiority." End quote. Hitler asked Goering to amass a great secret reserve of fighter aircraft, and he hoped someday to throw 2,000 fighters into the struggle for France. Since six new Mark 21 submarines had been delivered in July, and 144 were scheduled by the end of 1944, Germany must hold on to France. Hitler said that he himself would fly west to take command as he had in 1940, but his damaged eardrums made it impossible to fly. Quote, "Obviously," he said on July 31st, "if all the dams burst, I would do anything and wouldn't care. I'd go as a gunner in a single-engined plane to get there as fast as possible." End quote. He reflected, quote, "The miracle is that the shock got rid of my nerve complaint almost entirely. My left leg still trembles somewhat if conferences go on too long, but previously this leg used to shake in bed. With this shock, that's vanished almost completely. Not that I would recommend this kind of remedy." End quote. The assassin's bomb had affected Hitler more than he liked to admit. His right ear had often begun to bleed. His eyes constantly flicked to the right, nystagmus. Alone in his bunker, he kept thinking he was falling over to the right. That evening, he went for a short walk in the twilight and twice found himself wandering off the path. There was a constant taste of blood in his mouth. An army ear, nose, and throat expert, Dr. Erwin Giesing, was fetched from Rostenburg. He cauterized the ruptured right eardrum, and the ear still bled. And on July 23rd, Professor von Eichen came to find out why. Hitler joked, quote, "Perhaps I'm just a natural bleeder," unquote. The next day, he asked Giesing to cauterize the ear again, regardless of the pain. Quote, "I stopped feeling pain long ago," he observed. "Besides, pain exists to make a man of you," end quote. Eichen had told him that perforating an eardrum was just about the most painful injury there was. Pensively, Hitler remarked later to Sonnleitner, quote, "I got both eardrums perforated, yet I don't feel a thing. It happened so fast. I didn't feel a thing. It happened so fast. That's probably how it is when you shoot yourself, too. Even if you shoot yourself in the mouth rather than the brain, I know you don't feel a thing," end quote. Sonnleitner wondered why the Führer felt bound to pass this revelation on to him. Visiting the hospital at nearby Rostenburg, Hitler talked with Schmunt and others injured in the blast. Two beds were empty. Gunther Corton, chief of air staff, had died of his injuries on July 22nd, and Colonel Brandt, promoted on the deathbed to general to benefit his widow, had succumbed the same day. Corton would get a state funeral, but not Brandt. Walter Scherf, Hitler's court historian, had shared his ward and reported that the colonel had complained in his delirium that at Stauffenberg's callousness in planting the bomb at his feet when Brandt was one of the conspirators himself. Each day revealed more names of conspirators. Zeitzler's adjutant, Colonel Smint, contritely confessed. Virtually every section head of the Army General Staff except Reinhard Galen and Rudolf Gerke was involved. The implication of Colonels Hansen and Rona, the intelligence chiefs in the West, seemed to throw light on many otherwise inexplicable failures. So did the sudden suicide of General Edward Wagner, the Army's quartermaster general, and the disappearance of General Lindemann, the director of artillery. Hitler became convinced that General Feldgebel's signals organization had instantly flashed his secrets to the enemy. Quote, Feldgebel must confess, he raged, if he has to be skinned alive, end quote. Even Arthur Nibby, the Gestapo department chief, had vanished without a trace, as had Karl Gerdauer, twice appointed mayor of Leipzig, and since then provided an abundant pension by the Führer. Gerdauer's papers were located in a hotel safe. They revealed that he had been chosen to succeed Hitler, and they listed additional conspirators. These were arrested, and fresh chain reactions were established by their interrogation. On July 23rd, Admiral Canaris was picked up by the Gestapo. Hans Halder and Helmar Schacht, pre-war governor of the Reichsbank, were also pulled in, as their opposition to Hitler was well documented. Bormann began showing Hitler the lengthy interrogation reports. They did not spare the Führer's feelings. Quote, I could not bear to watch this man running amok, one conspirator, General Stief, had blurted out, smashing his own great works by his obstinacy. We are defending Kirkenes and Crete, but we shall be losing Königsberg and Krakow in the process. End quote. Over half of the traitors were army officers, but there were also trade union officials, lawyers, and clergy. Even Count Wolf von Heldorf, the Jew baiter whom Hitler had made police president of Berlin, confessed to being one of Stauffenberg's minions. None had much clue as to what they were proposing in Hitler's place. They questioned his orders for the rigid defense of the Donets Bend, the Dnieper Line, and the Nikopol Bridgehead, the Crimea, the Narva Line, the Vitebsk Salient, and Cherkasy Pocket, but there was a class element, too. He was the son of an Austrian customs official to whom the officer corps felt bound by neither blood nor brotherhood. Gradually, the Gestapo reconstructed the assassination attempt. An English time fuse had been used. From Abwehr stocks, a second package of explosive was found where Stauffenberg's adjutant had jettisoned it from their car as they sped back to the airfield. Had they used it also, their plot might have succeeded. Stauffenberg had also carried his explosives to the Berghof on July 11th and to Rostenburg 4 days later, but not used them. These riddles would remain unsolved, for General Fromm had invited Beck to put a bullet in his brains, and he had rushed Stauffenberg and his adjutant in front of a firing squad before the Gestapo could get at them. Count von Heldorf's full confession was handed to Hitler as he was being treated by the Ent specialist Dr. Giesing. Quote, Who would have thought Heldorf was such a rat? End quote, asked Hitler. Quote, That he was irresponsible was obvious enough from his gambling debts. How often I had to settle them for him, 4 or 5 times, and never less than 100,000 marks. A gambler like that was bound to fall into the hands of enemy agents, and the British Secret Service no doubt settled even bigger debts on his behalf. I'm sorry for his wife and pleasant children, end quote, he added, laying the confession aside. Okay. Quote, But I must clean out this Augean stable with an iron broom, and there can be no mercy. How thankful I am to Riemer, a few more fine, clear-thinking officers like him, and I wouldn't have to worry about the future. But this yellow gang sends me even more yellow-bellied Stauffenberg from Berlin. if he'd at least had the courage to stay there with his briefcase. But no, it was a pity to waste even one bullet on him. I keep asking myself what they were all there, what they were all after, as though Stalin or Churchill or Roosevelt would have been bothered one instant by our sudden desire for peace. In 8 days, the Russians would have been in Berlin, and it would have been all over for Germany, for good, end quote. He ordered that the police chief was to watch every hanging until his own turn for the noose came. A letter had come from Eva Braun in Bavaria. It ended, quote, right after our very first meetings, I promised myself I would follow you everywhere, even unto death. You know I live only for the love I can give to you, end quote. Hitler's escape had brought the entire German population together. It was reported that the army generals in Berlin had to conceal their uniforms beneath raincoats to escape the people's indignation. Quote, I just heard the frightful news, a Viennese widow wrote to Hitler. Did nothing happen to you, really? Mein Führer, you are all that is left to me in this world. I had a child, but he died in action in Russia at Mayevka. He had passed his examinations and had a place waiting at a technical college. I had been saving up for this, but now he'll never return. My darling child. Take my money out of joy that nothing befall the Führer. End quote. A lock of hair and a picture of the boy accompanied the letter, which reached Hitler via the propaganda ministry. Goebbels himself arrived at the Wolf's Lair on July 22nd, bent on asking for semi-dictatorial powers. Hitler regaled him with details of his miraculous escape. After the blast, he said, his first instinct had been to check that his eyes and limbs were intact. The minister was deeply moved by Hitler's appearance. Quote, he was just coming out of this little headquarters bunker, he wrote in Das Reich, not wary but relaxed, not bowed but with his head slightly sunk, a picture to melt the sternest heart, end quote. A preliminary conference between Bormann, Speer, and Goebbels preceded the full session on July 23rd with Hitler, Goering, and Himmler. Hitler ordered Goering to appoint the propaganda minister, quote, Reich Commissar for Total War Mobilization, unquote, and announced, despite the misgivings of his physicians, that he would speak to the Gauleiters in a week's time. Speaking to Goebbels, he vented his fury at, quote, unquote, that Masonic lodge. The general staff, that's what he's referring to. He was going to have the traitors turned over to Judge Roland Freisler and the People's Court, not trusting Army Courts Martial to give them their true deserts. Quote, he is the greatest historic genius of our times, Goebbels dictated to his diary on July 23rd. With him, we shall see victory or go down heroically, end quote. His diary for July 19th to 22nd is missing, perhaps never dictated, perhaps destroyed by his own hand. Hitler now trusted nobody. Every officer who came into his presence was frisked. His food was tasted. He ordered the uniformed and bemedaled corpses of Stauffenberg and others shot by firing squad in Berlin to be exhumed, lest the army had deceived him. Of humble and haughty alike, the heads began to roll. The Gerdeler list had suggested Count von der Schulenburg, the former ambassador in Moscow, as quote-unquote foreign minister. Schulenburg protested his innocence on his word of honor. Ribbentrop felt this was good enough, but his legal staff did not. The ambassador was sentenced to hang. Sonnleitner pleaded secretly with Hitler to spare him, in vain. Quote, My own life is unimportant, responded Hitler evenly, but anybody who lifts his hand against the state in wartime must be destroyed, end quote. Robert Ley broadcast a speech blaming Germany's, quote, blue-blooded swine, end quote, for plotting their Führer's death. This brought such an aristocratic field marshal, von Richthofen, to the Wolf's Lair in full dress regalia, formally protesting this slur on his breed. Hitler pointed to his adjutants von Billow, von Puttkamer, and Erich von Amsberg as proof that he valued men only for their accomplishments. He signed an order forbidding any intemperate criticism of the officer corps and the nobility at large, but in private he regretfully speculated that he might have done better to opt for Rom as his revolutionary SA army against the regular Reichswehr in 1934, and he declared yet again that Stalin had been right to purge his officer corps in 1937. Treachery became the staple explanation now for his defeats. The supply of bazookas supplied one example. Quote, "Who issues these weapons?" asked Hitler angrily. Keitel shrugged. Quote, "That was the quartermaster general Wagner," end quote. Quote, "Aha!" triumphed Hitler. "That swine! He did well to shoot himself. In the open countryside of the Ukraine, we have bazookas in abundance, and in the hedgerows of Normandy, we have none. He did it on purpose," end quote. Goering did what he could to restore Hitler's trust. On July 23rd, a staff stenographer noted, quote, "Before today's noon war conference, the Reichsmarshal delivered a short speech to the Führer proposing that as an outward token of gratitude for his miraculous escape, the entire Wehrmacht should adopt the Hitler salute forthwith," end quote. But each new report from Kaltenbrunner started fresh tumors festering. By the end of July 1944, two names had cropped up that Hitler had never expected to see among the plotters, Field Marshals von Kluge and Rommel. The allegation was so awesome that two weeks passed before Hitler could decide how to act on it. End chapter.